Welcome to the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series created by Robert Jordan.
At its conclusion, the series will consist of 14 novels and one prequel novel.
Sadly, Robert Jordan did not live to see his work complete.
Brandon Sanderson, appointed by Mr. Jordan's widow, Harriet Rigney, will complete the series with the novels The Gathering Storm, Towers of Midnight, and A Memory of Light, based on the notes left by Mr. Jordan.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Fourth Age podcast's continuing recap of The Gathering Storm. I, of course, am Andrew Kellos, and with me this episode is Virginia.
Hi, Andrew. Thanks for joining us. It's good to be here, as always, and also with us this episode is Spencer.
Hi, everyone. It's great to be here again. Like Andrew said, we're going to be continuing our recap of The Gathering Storm. We're going to be starting with Chapter 38, but before we jump into that, a couple of things we have to take care of. First off...
Message, California, sir.
Well, what does it say, Patsy?
It says here that The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series, and that this podcast may contain spoilers.
Right then, butcher the cow, we'll have some steak.
Yes, obviously we're discussing the Towers, not the Towers of Midnight, we might, but we're discussing The Gathering Storm, and so obviously there's going to be spoilers of The Gathering Storm, and all the other books in the series, so if you haven't read them all, you probably want to save this podcast, come back to it later after you have.
Yes, or you'll be spoiled. But we'll also try very hard to let you know if we cross over and spoil the ends of other series, which we have inadvertently done in the past, so... All bets are off here. We're going to be talking about pretty much everything you can think about. Not always, but
yeah,
we can.
Yeah, and then the second thing we need to take care of right off the bat is we want to thank Encyclopedia Watt for all the work they had done for putting together the chapter summaries that we're actually basing our summaries off of. We don't read them quite verbatim, but most of the content actually is being provided by Encyclopedia Watt, so we want to thank them for that.
Yeah, and that's encyclopedia-watt.org. So check it out if you want a really fantastic lesson for the Wheel of Time.
So we're going to start our recap, as Spencer said, Chapter 38, News in Teleronriad. The chapter is from Egwene's point of view in a meeting in Teleronriad. Sawan tries to convince Egwene that Elida will never let her go. They've been meeting almost every night now. This time they're meeting in Nauerman Mishinta's cobbler's shop in Tarvalon. They debate whether Elida could have her executed. After Egwene ends the discussion, Sawan tells her that Gawain is in the camp. He keeps meeting with Lelaine and Ramonda. Their meeting last night was cut short by another bubble of evil where the tents came alive and strangled three people. Egwene's cell is quite tiny. She thinks Rand must have felt even worse when Elida had him in the box. Sawan thinks Egwene may be the best Merlin seat since Arthur Hawkwing's reign. After Sawan leaves, Egwene visits the rebel camp surrounded by Bryn's army. She wonders if the rebels will fragment in the same way the White Tower sisters have. She wonders if there will ever be reconciliation, if there will be two separate White Towers. She lets herself use need. She finds herself in a clearing, in a forest of white aspen. There is a small group of tinkers' wagons, and an actual fire, which is odd for Teleronriad. She wonders what place there will be for tinkers and the way of the leaf in the last battle. She wonders what became of Aram, Rain, and Ilya. She wonders why need has brought her there. Is she too focused? Life should be, of course, about living, as the tinkers treat it. She thinks about Gawain and the rebel camp, and she intends to bond him as her warder and marry him. She lets the world shift again. She stands in front of the White Tower, its shadow cast upon her. She wakes to renewed pain. She is still wearing the same bloody dress that she has been in since her disastrous meeting with Elida. The Red Sisters, who guard her cell now, administer her beatings instead of Sylviana. At noon, her guards, Burstein and another Red that she does not know, bring her out of the cell for her beating. Caterin arrives with news that Egwene is to be freed and returned to the novice quarters. Caterin is the new mistress of novices. On their way, they run into Saren. Saren tells Egwene that Sylviana confronted Elida and the hall, demanding Egwene's release. Elida ordered her imprisoned. The two Reds look concerned. Egwene tells them they should go and check on what is happening to their Aja. She asks a passing novice, Barisail, to bring four recruits so Reds can leave. Barisail and Egwene proceed to her room, and Marisail returns with the pork root. Egwene downs it, and then hurries away. Egwene enters her room, and finds that Varen is waiting for her. Egwene begins to change her dress in order to get to work, but Varen shocks her by lying about the color of Egwene's dress. She then tells Egwene to sit down, as they have a lot to talk about.
Well, other than the obvious lead-in to the next chapter in this particular book, I think the thing that hit me the most is Egwene using mead. And it didn't seem like she really got anything from it. It seemed a little bit unresolved in a way to me. Is it just me? Or?
Well, it's an interesting thing because mead doesn't... I mean, the way Robert Jordan set up the using mead seems a little disjointed here, because she uses mead and she comes to the Tinker camp, and then she uses mead again, and seemingly rather than it, you know, coming closer to the thing she needs, she appears in Tarvalon instead.
Yeah.
And yeah. I'm not certain if they're trying to say that there's something about the Tinkers that needs to be associated with the White Tower, or that, you know, something central to them has to come into play within the bounds of the Aes Sedai or the White Tower that is going to then be what is needful. I mean, we didn't get to see a third shift to come any closer, you know, and then there was always the idea that, you know, going to so affluent in how to work within Teleronriad now that it could just be that she decided that, well, the Tinker camp is nice, but it's not going to get me anywhere. I'm going to start a different path, and like they did with the Bowl of Winds, kind of, you know, concentrated on a different need in order to get where they were going. I don't know.
Yeah, I was sitting here sort of trying to read through that section to figure out exactly what she was going for there. I mean, she needs to bring the White Tower together. She needs to preserve the people, the world, and the White Tower in the face of Tarvalon Gaiden, but maybe it's because, see, she was just looking not for an object, but for knowledge, it says. So what did she need to know, and what did she need to see to accomplish that goal of trying to save the tower, all of the people in the world, and the world from disaster with Tarvalon Gaiden? And maybe that's why it was a little nebulous. So clearly, if we are going to assume that mead is definitely working, that the Tinkers are important in some really crucial way. But honestly, I can't see how, except maybe as a... The problem with going to war in general is that a nation and a people can get so wrapped up in it that becomes the goal to the exclusion of all else, and it becomes a destructive driving force sometimes rather than, you know, a positive one. Most nations are going to war either to conquer somebody else, which is rather destructive in nature, or to defend themselves, and defense quickly becomes sometimes hatred and other things. And so, you know, they can all go the way of Iredal. So maybe the Tinkers are going to be really crucial in the last battle to provide a counterweight to all the negativity, if you will, that will come along. But there's so few, it's it's hard to see how they could be really critical. I mean, what they really reminded, what popped into my head here more than anything was the image from the glass array to Rangreal and Meridian, where the Aiel are all standing shoulder to shoulder in front of one of the mad male channelers who is slowly destroying them one at a time. And they're arm in arm singing until the last person was dead. And they did that in order that it could distract this man until most of the people were really able to escape. And that's the kind of courage and dedication, the true dedicated, the Aiel, the Tinkers, are known for from the Age of Legends. Maybe they don't even remember that now, but maybe that's what's needed here. I'm sort of going pretty far afield at this. That section of the chapter really surprised me, in a way, because circling with needs seems to have worked so obviously before, but apparently it works better for us than an abstract.
Well, I mean, I find it, interesting, and you know, they mention that, of course, the fire is unusual for Telerongrad in the Tinker camp. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, that definitely implies that those Tinkers, if nothing else, have sort of created an almost semi-permanent, they had to have been there wherever they are for quite a while for the fire to have lasted. And, you know, I'm kind of wondering if the main purpose of the camp isn't just to remind Egwene what's important. I mean, she goes through this very long little section here that, where she examines, you know, why she's trying to secure the White Tower, why she would have chosen the green over the blue, and, you know, various other things, and it leads her to her decision about Gawain and various other things like that. And so, if she's looking for knowledge, I mean, the first place you really have to start is in yourself. If you find out what is true for you, what there is that is important for you before you can go out and search in other places for it. And you know, as she kind of points out in the chapter, the Tinkers, when she visited them, was a simpler time in her life when, you know, the things that were important kind of just came to her naturally. And now, you know, it's all wrapped up in politics and then other things like that, you know, seem important, but, you know, how important actually are they? The other thing in this chapter that...
Are you moving on to another topic? I was going to make a comment. I just didn't want to...
Oh, yeah, no, go ahead. Sorry.
Okay.
I'll bring that up.
No, it's my fault, totally. I like what you were saying about the Tinkers. I think I pretty much agree with that, and the way that she's using knowledge is teaching her as much about herself as it is something about the outside world. But I kind of go back to that fire, and I think it's possible that it's an offshoot of the semi-permanent nature of the camp. But as I recall, an actual fire in Telerongrad, like so many other things, is just almost unheard of, and I'm wondering if that doesn't have more to do with the breakdown of reality and the thinning of barriers between the real world and Telerongrad and nothingness, basically. Not that we can do anything about that, but that sort of seems to me what it is. I think the other kind of funny thing about that is that, you know, she's wondering if there will ever be a reconciliation and if there will be two White Towers, and I'm surprised she's even considering that as a possibility. I guess you have to think about all options, but...
That's true. I mean, it is just that... It is the nature that, I mean, she's had the dream where, you know, the Shanshan attack topples... Or not topples, but, you know, unbalances the tower, and, the, you know, there are tiny little flames all over the place that are scattered from the larger oil lamp. She's not completely interpreted that particular... You know, dream to its fullest. I mean, she knows that, you know, the White Tower is going to be severely shaken by the attack, and that, and it just, you know, it could also bring into mind, you know, that there's no guarantee that the tower itself is going to remain or ever actually be put back together, since it's been divided. And, of course, Egwene herself represents the major reason that the Aes Sedai haven't just, capitulated and given in to Elida by now, is really, her strength of will. She has driven this war since, almost most immediately since coming to Tarvalon itself. Back in Saladar, it was all nice to say, oh yes, we're rebels, we're fighting against, the usurper and everything, but, once Egwene actually has them unload to Tarvalon and actually set up the camps and the siege, at that point forward, she really drove the war. And, if she had been allowed to return to the camp, I think that would have been detrimental to that cause. I think even, so much as being, acting the way she has under her imprisonment has continued to be the focus of, look, I'm not giving in and I've been captured. You're going to continue to fight this war because this war needs to be fought.
Yeah, I think actually getting captured gave her a real leg up on things, but I still think that even if she'd remained in camp, she would have been able to keep the war effort going, especially, when they're within sight of Tarvalon. I think it's just a matter of time. Egwene is clearly, probably in the very first book, one of the most underestimated characters in the entire book. You just never know how much and how well people are going to be able to grow into the situations that life thrusts onto them, and she's certainly done more than her share. And I think it's kind of significant, too, that Sawan even tells her that she no longer thinks that she has the potential to truly be Amalyn and be a great Amalyn. She's there.
Yeah. One of the other things in this chapter, and again, it's building on Egwene as a Merlin, is, she wakes up from Teller Onriad, and, the Red Sea sisters have taken her out of the cell, and this, news comes in that Sylviana, probably one of the most prominent Reds in the tower right now, confronted Elida, but did so in front of the hall, and basically just took Egwene's cause on her behalf. Not necessarily because she likes Egwene particularly or anything, but because it was the right thing to do. And I mean, we get an instance here of a Red Sister acting strictly as, as a person should act, getting, the humaneness. You see a Red Sister coming in and actually just standing up for what is right and trying to bring that sense of justice. I mean, cause one of the big things, I cannot remember now who originally put the idea forth, is that the Reds aren't necessarily about just finding and stilling men who can channel, or severing men who can channel. They are, in some ways, more than the Gray about justice. They are, whereas the Green are set up to be the War Aj, the Reds are sort of set up in the overall structure of the tower to be like the police force. And for a long time now, they haven't really been acting like it, or haven't been acting that role well. And so Sylviana comes out, she does what she should do, and stands up, for someone who can't stand up for themselves in this particular case. And of course, she's immediately thrown into prison and, threatened with so much as even possibly being on, the list to be, stilled as a traitor. And, Egwene's immediate reaction is, look at what is happening to your own Aj. Go and fix this, or go and find out what's going on. You should be involved with each other. If you're not involved with anyone else, at least you should be standing up for the people in your own, Aja. So, and the fact that, one of her Reds just goes ahead and leaves. You know, it does the entire, you know, essentially bowing to the will of the Merlin and just, you know, goes and does what she knows is right. And, you know, Barristan, of course, is going to be stubborn until the fork root arrives. You know, it's just the fact that Egwene, you know, sits there, she gets the fork root, she takes it just because she's like, we don't have time to deal with this. You need to preserve your Aja. You know, as long as you get satisfied that I'm, you know, I've done what I needs to be done to keep me in check, you know, I don't care. You know, this is about the good of the tower and not about me, so.
Yeah, that's been her drum that since she was captured. And how amazing is that? I mean, you know, just imagine most people that I know or most characters that I've thought of, it would have been so simple for Egwene to go into the White Tower captive and be divisive, you know, increase the divisiveness between cultures, you know, and to basically add the chaos that's happening and further split the White Tower in order to try and achieve her goals. That would have been the most natural thing in the world, especially for Aes Sedai that are schooled in the game of houses, you know, they just basically invented the thing. And she didn't do that. Her thing from the beginning is, you know, not to obey the sisters, you know, that's your faith. You know, accept it, you know, continue to increase your knowledge and work toward becoming a sister, whatever Haja it is. She's never, you know, berated the Red for doing what she's done, and she's never even really, I mean, she's criticized Elida, but I don't want to say in a constructive fashion, but she has criticized her basically not as an evil person or a person of ill will or anything like that, but as somebody who's just really misguided and just doing the wrong thing. And this whole thing has been, we need to bring the White Tower together. And I think that, and anything else, has affected every sister that she's been in contact, and it's basically probably spread by now just by word of mouth. And she could not have done anything better to try to bring the White Tower together than what she did. It's really quite astonishing when you consider how really young and inexperienced she is. She has wisdom far beyond her years. I thought it was pretty significant that Sylviana, you know, who basically was, not really in an adversarial role with Egwene from the beginning, but almost, you know, Egwene defied her nonstop since she got into the tower. And Sylviana was so impressed with her integrity and what was being done that she defied her own Aja and Elida the Amalensi, someone known to be basically a psychotic nutcase when it came to being defied, and stood up in front of the whole tower to defend her. I mean, you could have knocked me down when I read that. I went, wow, go Sylviana, you know? She's really, truly bringing out the best in everybody. She really is. It's quite astonishing. You know, really, she's what Rand should have been and could have been if he hadn't been so damaged by his circumstances. And I think that she and Rand together are going to be a really powerful force in the last battle. I think there's going to be, a necessity for them to come together and almost fight as a unit. I don't know that, but that's sort of been growing in my mind lately. And then the other aside that I have to make is when you were talking about the Red Aja meetings, they basically were police first red shirts. Or red arms. One of the two.
I'll go with the red shirts.
Please.
Yeah.
Please make them red. No,
they certainly probably come farthest away from their mission statement of any of the Ajas.
Yeah.
They've just taken themselves down a path that's led them, you know, to become completely disconnected from the best goals of the White Tower. And I think that we certainly see them changing. I mean, that was another thing that you could have absolutely, I never would have guessed that Reds would ever come to bond. I could have maybe guessed that Reds could bring themselves to bond waters because Pravara had been saying that, and she got to the level of Sitter, that, you know, she had been saying that actually having a warder would make the Reds' job easier, obviously. But that they would actually go so far as to do that and only bond men that were channelers. That, didn't see that one coming.
This is true. This chapter also, of course, gives us, as the readers, one of our biggest shocks, whether it's a shock of gratification and, you know, I've been saying it all along, or, you know, a shock of, you know, just sheer surprise and, you know, on some people's parts, dismay. And that's, of course, you know, Egwene comes into her room. She finds Varen there. And she says, there isn't time right now, Varen. Quickly opening the small locker that contained her extra dress. I have work to be about. Yes, Varen said, taking a calm sip of her tea. I suspect that you do. By the way, that dress you were wearing is green. Egwene frowned at the nonsense sentence, glancing down at her dress. Of course it wasn't green. What was Varen saying? Had the woman become... She froze, glancing at Varen. That had been a lie. Varen could speak lies. Yes, I thought that might get your attention, Varen said, smiling. You should sit down. We have much to discuss and little time in which to do it. And you know, it just, you know, that I know we discussed this particularly in the Varen episode of the podcast. But it is, it just, we have, since book two, had that lingering doubt about, well, how did Varen lie? And of course, you know, our next chapter is going to lead into, you know, the explanation of this. But it's just the idea that so far we've always trusted what any Aes Sedai, you know, even to some extent what blacks say at face value as being the truth, because Aes Sedai don't lie. And of course we know the blacks are capable of lying. So, you know, it's the question of, well, you know, now do we go back and, you know, how much do we trust of anything that Varen's ever said? Because she's capable of lying. That doesn't necessarily mean she's required to do so. And for a lot of the black, I imagine, keeping the oath not to lie is actually a good bit easier than not doing so.
Well, yeah, and it's definitely required to keep up the facade that they are an Aes Sedai, to throw off suspicion, is to, as much as possible, stick to the oath, kind of like Egwene's doing. I don't have the oath on me, but I stick to it anyway, as much as I can.
I think we'll just move on then to chapter 39, which is entitled A Visit from Varen's. This chapter is from Egwene's point of view, and it begins with Egwene accusing Varen of never holding the oath rod and then of having the oath removed like Eukarion Saren. Varen admits that she is Black Aja, and she is sipping she tells Egwene that she is sipping a cup of poisoned tea, aspen rot root, I believe it was, which allows her to get around one of her new oaths as one of the Black Aja, which is, I swear not to betray the Great Lord, to keep my secrets until the hour of my death. Her imminent death now allows her to reveal all of these secrets to Egwene. Varen has learned of the Black Aja. Varen tells her that she had learned about the Black Aja and was investigating them and ended up having to join or be executed. Her warder, Tomas, is also a dark friend, and he was one who wanted out, and so he joined her as a warder. Varen used the opportunity to study the Black Aja, and she tells Egwene to thank Laris for the aspen rot tea. Varen worries about Rand. She thinks that he understands how the Forsaken work, like selfish children, but he does not understand the Great Lord at all. Battle is not being fought the way Rand thinks. She is amazed that Egwene has been so successful against Elida. She then gives Egwene her last work, her study of the Black Aja. There's a thick red book with her notes, and a thin blue one with the code to decipher the red one. She also shows her a leather bookstrap, which is a tarongrial that renders both books invisible. Egwene thinks these books are as great a treasure as the Horn of Valir in their way. Varen tells her that Mithana is in the White Tower and that she needs to be careful of her. She has met her twice, but could not identify her as a sister. Varen tells her that she was not supposed to give Egwene the Twisted Ring Dream Tarongrial when she was sent to hunt the Black Aja so long ago, but she did anyway. After a few more minutes of discussion, Varen dies. The door to Egwene's room opens, and a young red sister, Teresa, looks in. Egwene implies with that line that Varen is asleep, so Teresa closes the door. And wonders what is going on with Sylviana and Elida. Jumps and uses the time to read. The list of Black Aja includes Katarine, Aldiaran, Elsa Penfall, Galena Caspan, and Sheriam. Egwene suspected Sheriam at the time of Riandrin's betrayal, but has grown to like her since. There are over 200 Black Aja altogether. 21 are blue, 28 brown, 30 gray, 38 green, 17 white, 21 yellow, and 48 red. Sisters for the Tower and the Rebels include Duhara Bafahim, Alina Bahar, Sidora Dajena, Sidori Dajena, Delena Mussolain, Salim Ninley, and Moria Kalantanis. Others are Dara Finchley, Zanika, Larissa Lindell, Niasi, Nafisa, Nafel Kayama, Ed Boyle, Thurlin Panna, Melvara, and Chai Rugat. Elida, Elaine, Ramonda, and Cadswain are not on the list. Egwene thinks that Galena and Alviar were manipulating Elida. Finally, there is a knock on the door, and the novice Teresa admits Nicola with a tray of food for Viren sent by Laris. Egwene expects her allies to know about Viren, so she checks the food and finds a vial containing the message that says to wait. She does, and soon Mediani arrives. Egwene tells her that Viren is dead, poisoned by a dark friend, and that she brought crucial information to Egwene. Mediani tells her that Elida is still on the run, but just barely. The Hall has censured her. Viviana is still imprisoned. All of the Red Aja sisters are missing. Egwene tells her that they must capture Alviarin. Part of Viren's message is that she is a Black Aja leader. Mediani and the others had the Ophrod while they were attempting to decide whether Nicola was Black Aja or not. She is one of Egwene's most ardent supporters now. Egwene orders Mediani to take Viren's body and travel to remove it. After she leaves, Egwene goes to sleep. In Teleronriad, Egwene waits for Solon at the Spring Garden. While she waits, she thinks on Sharium. Did Sharium bring the Gray Man way back when? She was part of the circle that healed Nat. Was she aware of the plan to dispose Solon with the Tower's human part of the Dark One's plan? She thinks the Dark One would laugh at his success and then wonders if the Dark One even laughed. Solon then arrives, and Egwene tells her to have Sharium and Moria watched because they are Black Aja. Solon asks if she is still a prisoner, and Egwene starts to answer, but she is shaken awake by a panicked Nicola. She cries that shadows are attacking the White Tower. It is the last battle. Egwene realizes that it is not the last battle, but it is the Shanshan attack. Wow. There is so much in that chapter, I don't even know where to start.
There is a lot in this chapter, and obviously, we finally get our first look at the kind of oaths that the Black Aja have to swear. And maybe not just the Black Aja. There may actually be certain ways, certain binding oaths for all Dark Friends, which are this way. But, obviously for an Aes Sedai, it's more binding using the actual oath rod. But of course, I swear I will not betray the great Lord to keep my secrets until the hour of my death. And it's really odd, and we've conjectured about this, at why there's such a seemingly obvious loophole.
Yeah.
In this particular oath. I mean, the Dark One does not seem to be the kind of entity that just, thrives on flowery, lyrical language, the concept of until the hour of my death. It just seems really, why give them that particular out? As an evil overlord, you can't always ever expect all of your henchmen to completely remain under your sway for the entirety of their existence. It's not practical, And so the idea that, the Dark One built in this kind of escape clause just seems really, really bizarre.
I know. And the problem with running a band of evil henchmen is that they're evil. They're not big on, doing the right thing. So giving them a loophole like this seems absolutely like madness to me. I can't imagine that, I sort of maybe think of when Sylviana's in the Sun of Tears, she's telling him to laugh, telling Egwene that, laugh at Ashamiel and the Dark One, call them fools, they don't like that. But it's kind of odd sometimes. It's weird. You would think that somebody who is planning to, overthrow the Creator and remake the world in his image would have a little bit more of a clue than to leave a big loophole like that with people who are just going to look for any loophole to betray him at the first sign of advantage.
Yeah, true.
It is sort of like being the Sith in Star Wars. And the whole way apprentices rise up is by assassinating their masters. Why would you ever want to take an apprentice?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, that's has kind of been a thing that's, I mean, there was nothing about, you know, necessarily needing to rise up and destroy your master until the prequel trilogy. You know, that seems, yes, evil geniuses, loopholes that seem to counteract, you know, intelligent, you know, thought. One of the other, you know, little side things here, and it just, again, it proves the depth with which, you know, Robert Jordan and now Brandon Sanderson have thought about the series and the intricacy of the plot. And that's, again, we get the nudge that Laris, Mistress of Kitchens, is a lot more than she appears. I mean, I'm gonna cook and be in charge of the people preparing the food for literally a sorority of thousands of women. And I just so happen to know and have in my possession a tea which masks the flavor of one of the most potent and horribly painful poisons in existence.
Well, I can see her having, you know, a variety of different teas and knowing what would mask the flavor, but that she would go along with what Baron requested without quibbling is what surprised me. You know, it makes me wonder. I mean, what would most people do if you came in and said, here, I'm going to take this poison which is going to kill me, but I really need something that's going to cover the flavor because it just tastes terrible. You know? How many people are going to go along with that? And I bet there's no good Chinese in this place either. Oh, no, wait, I think the Chinese food here is probably terrible. Okay, we don't think we've had any My Cousin Vinny crossovers lately.
Yeah, no, that's a...
Oh, you blend. Don't get me started. I'll be good. I swear I'll be good. I'll try. Yeah, I don't know. I that she apparently let Laris in on what she was doing was what surprised me. I mean, it would have been ever so much easier for Baron to say something like, you know, I just need a really strong tasting tea with a lot of honey in it. Something like that, you know. Oh, I'm in the mood for something really, really tart, you know, or whatever. I mean, you know, she could have said anything without letting her in on it.
Yes, but I mean, part of this and part of letting Laris in on the plan was that Laris then had to be able to send the message to Egwene that said, wait here, don't arouse suspicion, we're going to take care of the body. I mean, Laris is instrumental in, you know, having people sent that can deal with, you know, Varen's corpse and do it in a way that is surreptitious enough that nobody's going to be suspicious of everything. You know, that the idea that Egwene is able to tell the entire truth, you know, Varen was murdered by a, you know, poisoned by a dark friend and is dead. And obviously, we can't have her body here. You know, it's just something that, that does. I mean, it requires a lot of really ingenious planning. And,
yeah,
you know, that, you know, that Laris is, you know, able to foresee enough of the plan that, you know, she can send Mediani in. And, you know, that can, you know, and it can all be taken care of. It's just, you know, really astounding.
I mean, it's kind of something else. It's maybe kind of obvious. Maybe I'm just missing something, but Varen's been gone, as far as we know, doing things for quite some time. How did she know who Gwen's allies are? How did she know that Laris would cooperate and assist her in assisting Egwene? How did she know about Mehdani or any of these people? I mean, maybe she didn't know about Mehdani, but how did she know that Laris was part of Egwene's group?
I don't know. I mean, it's very possible that Laris has been a confidant for some time, regardless of, you know, whether she's, you know, a dark friend or just, you know, a regular, you know, regardless of what Laris is, that, you know, she's been a confidant enough, she's a source of information within the tower, I don't know how much it stretches to say that Loras would have been apprised that Egwene had been released back to her rooms, considering that, I mean, obviously she would have had to have been told because food for Egwene would have had, you know, would have to have shifted. But, I mean, there's not a whole lot of time between her release and her going back to the room. I'm kind of guessing that Varen may have first appeared to one of the other Black Sisters that were in the tower and said, you know, and basically gotten like a quick update, trying to assess the situation. Yeah. You know, it's there that, I mean, it might have been in that particular, sort of interview with another Black Sister where Varen learned that the Oath Rod had gone missing. I mean, Varen is privy to a lot of information that someone who just showed up in the tower wouldn't necessarily have access to.
It makes me wonder if Loras isn't running some sort of an eyes and ears network for somebody. My first thought was maybe she was the key contact for Lyanna's network inside Tavalon itself. But there really hasn't been much contact between her, and she's never mentioned her, so that's entirely possible. Life of Dire Secretive. But maybe she's part of a larger network that, well, maybe Varen has her own eyes and ears network all over the place. A lot of sisters have their own personal networks. And maybe Loras is part of it in the White Tower.
It's
a really good way to, it's a really good way to keep up on things when you're running all over the world, you know. Of course, you know, getting pigeons back and forth when you're running all over the world is not that simple. You have to have some homing pigeons available in every city that you plan to visit. But that's why you have a network.
Yeah, exactly.
I guess. Yeah. That's kind of point to Loras is maybe having a larger role in things than I originally thought. It's really fascinating that we haven't seen these books before. The only book we really ever saw Varen making use of was her notebook in which she would do little sketches of flowers and so forth and so on. And she had apparently stacks of other coded books in her library. She didn't really tell Egwene about those. I wonder if the instructions for those are possibly in one of that packet of letters that she's sent here and there. And how was that?
What was that again? Sorry, I completely zoned there as I was reading a note.
I'm just wondering, those books, Tarangreal, the two books and the Tarangreal that keeps them invisible are really fascinating. The only book that we've really seen Varen with is her notebook with sketches and notes, and we know that she also has a whole stack of other notebooks with notes over, you know, her entire lifespan that are all in code that are presumably still in her rooms in the White Tower, the ones that she reflected someday she was going to have to give somebody the code to decipher those, but hopefully no time soon. And that she didn't tell Egwene about those, but I'm wondering if she didn't leave some of those instructions in one of the packet of letters that she had when she visited Matt. But then, if she has that packet of letters with all these instructions, I mean, maybe they were all innocuous and not revealing any Dark Aja secrets, but if she writes those out with the intention of not giving them to somebody until after she dies, does that wiggle through the loophole too? I mean, can she carry around a packet of letter revealing all of her secrets? As long as she has no intent to give them to anybody until the hour of her death. Or posthumously, I suppose. That seems like a big loophole.
Well, I mean, and the notes that are provided by Encyclopedia Watt do kind of postulate that the cipher that she uses could technically ensure that she doesn't accidentally betray, and therefore, you know, keeps the idea that, you know, she can't give the cipher to anyone prior to the hour of her death. But, you know, the information itself is technically out there, and if someone else were to steal the cipher, I mean, technically that's not betraying, that's being negligent. I mean, betrayal is a conscious action in this particular case is what I'm getting. So, you know, I'm guessing that by having written so much in cipher, she really was just covering her own, you know, end of things. So that, you know, on the off chance that things go drastically wrong, that, you know, she's still covered and allowed to maintain that oath.
Yeah. The number of people in that oath is astonishing to me. I can't believe that's the only thing that's stopping them from revealing secrets. I can think of any number of ways to get around that. Another thing that's pretty interesting here is I hadn't really thought of it, but the number of sitters for the Red Aja that are out of the tower doing things is kind of surprising. You know,
well, they're all out at
yeah,
this point.
Yeah, I know. I don't, it's like, who's running the place? I mean, they have no sitters. How
well,
is that?
I mean, you know, we do know where a few of them are.
Yeah,
Duhara's and Camelin.
Yeah.
And, you know, Pavara and Javindra are at the Black Tower. So we do know where they are. It just, yeah, again, it seems.
Well, and Galena, you know, is obviously with Sarava being her pet for the rest of her life, we hope. We don't know if, they don't really know what's happened to her, so we have to presume that they replaced her, but maybe they haven't yet. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, let's see, each Aja has three sitters, so yes, they must have replaced her.
Yeah, I think they figure that she's gone. I didn't think a number of people possibly assumed that she was killed at Dumai's Wells.
Yeah.
Because I seem to recall that being brought up as that no one had seen her since Dumai's Wells, and so they probably have that kind of assumption that, you know, amongst the charred and exploded bits of humanity just happens to be bits of Galena.
Yeah, well, that's kind of interesting. I mean, it seems like there would be some sort of white tower rule about all the sitters being gone. I mean, they're supposed to be sitting in the hall, not out running around. One, you could kind of understand, but all three of them seems a bit much. I mean, here's the hall sitting. Oh, guess what? No red. I mean, maybe the rest of them all just heave a big sigh of relief and go, "Who's good?" But I kind of doubt it. There are a couple of sisters here on Vera's list that we don't believe have met yet. Some of them are familiar, but I don't recall Nalana Florell, Biren Pena, Malvara, and Chai Rugen. I don't remember ever hearing about them. All the others, the ones in the tower, we've met before at various places. And it's really funny because the other ones that we haven't really met yet, the ones in the tower, we pretty much knew all of them except, I think, Sidori and Valina. I don't think we knew Valina that was a dark friend. I think Valina's a sitter too, isn't she? Isn't she part of Elina's hall? Pretty sure she was one of the, I have to look it up, but I'm pretty sure she was.
Yeah, I don't remember.
Sitters for the tower, they've got, and the rebels. Okay, I was going to say, because Morio is with the rebels. And so is Delana, of course. Interesting how the Black Aja had people in pretty much every camp. They're everywhere. I still think they've got to be more. I know she probably, you know, 95 or 96% of them, but you know what, all it takes is a couple to cause real chaos someplace, especially if they weren't uncovered by Vera, and they're really, really deep.
Well, yeah, and they also have to be out of the tower and the Aes Sedai camp here in the next couple of, well, by the end of the book, because, you know, Egwene is going to enact measures that, you know, are going to be, that are going to shake things up, particularly for anyone who's not able to be someplace else.
Mm-hmm.
So this life's work of Varen's is certainly a game changer for Egwene and, you know, the Aes Sedai in general, so.
Yeah, I knew there were a lot of Black Aja, but honestly, I never would have expected over 200 of them. That had to have been equally shocking for all of the, look at all of the Aes Sedai who've been sitting there maintaining for all these years that there isn't a Black Aja And there's, what are they like, I think when the towers split, there were a little over 1,000 sisters altogether, and 20% of them are black. Wow.
Yeah.
That's a pretty serious infiltration. You know, I just with that one fell swoop, you know, if even if Gawain didn't get all of them, she got most of them, I mean, that seriously diminished the numbers in the White Tower. I mean, they were whining and crying when one sister or two sisters were killed, you know, say trying to capture Loghain or in any other thing. So they were a loss the tower could hardly afford, but 200 and something? That's a serious hit. It's a good thing that Egwene has instituted her program and she's got all these new novices coming along and, you know, she's bringing all these other channelers to be associated with the tower because otherwise that would have basically undone the White Tower. And I would have to say that if the Dark One was that successful in getting black sisters infiltrated into the White Tower over all these years with as careful as they are not to, the proportions of Dark Prince in the Black Tower have got to be 2 or 3 times that, because he was able to get put in the door right off the bat, because we don't necessarily think that Nazim Prime is a good guy.
Yeah, yeah.
But on the other hand, Egwene certainly made a, well, you know, have this knowledge will certainly allow Egwene to make a pretty good sized dent in the number of Dread Lords available.
I mean, those that actually were in the tower itself, or associated with the tower, because obviously, if the Dark One can find, you know, men who can channel to be Dread Lords, it's very, very possible that, you know, there might not be, you know, weird non-Black Aja recruiting party type things too. You know, the Dark Friends find out they can channel. Well, we can send them to the tower and increase the ranks of the Black Aja, or we just see about getting them training elsewhere so that,
yeah,
you know, you've
wonder,
got a little backstock of secret evil channelers.
Well, yeah, it makes me wonder if these proportions hold in other societies like the Seafolk, you know, the Kin. Obviously, the Seanchan are pretty regulated. They might get passed, but there's got to be some Darkfen Seanchan. We know Suroth was one. There must be some Darkfen channelers, too, you know. Maybe there's a High Lord or High Lady that has a whole batch of Dark Friends full of Indomani, and I hesitate to go there, because Sorleo will probably come over and smack me, but what about the Aiel? Yeah, they kill Dark Friend Aiel whenever they find them, but maybe they don't always find them either. What if those proportions hold in the Aiel? Holy cow.
Yeah.
Seriously badass Dark Friend channelers. Wonder why, you know, channeling men among the Aiel are sent off to the Blight. They basically go off to the Blight to fight the Dark One. What if, now that things are changing, what if they don't do that? Maybe they go join the Black Tower. You know, see some Aiel Ashaman? How awesome would that be?
I mean, it's definitely possible. It would be odd because, obviously, you know, a part of the Black Tower is sword training.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Aiel are going to have a problem with that, but,
well,
you know, how do you...
Fears work. I'm sure as long as they're training in some sort of, you know, weapons training, that would probably be okay. I mean, let's face it, most guys with a sword can't take most Aiel.
True.
So I think that would probably, you know, I think they'd probably give them a pass on that, but we haven't heard of any going. Of course, maybe that's because there are no recruiting parties going to the Aiel, but surely all of the Aiel that are anywhere, you know, on this side of the spine of the, you know, world, they've heard of the Ashaman, and that they, I mean, there've got to be a stock of Aiel men, you know, like Drew Grady and Flynn. They're older guys who have never spontaneously channeled, but they had the spark, and when they went to the White Tower, it was discovered that they could channel. And once they started training, they learned. There's got to be a stock of older Aiel men like that. Rourke!
I don't know.
Wow.
I mean, it's hard to say.
In fact, you would think that there would be even more, because among the Aiel, the percentages and the Seafolk as well, because in Landland, basically the only channelers except for the kinswoman that we know about are all pretty much Aes Sedai. And the only ones that go on to have families and make more little channelers are the women who either don't have the spark and never are tested or are very weak and put out of the tower, but among the ideal wise ones, they're perfectly free to get married and have children and so forth and so on. So you would think that the percentage of channelers popping up among the Aiel would be far greater than non-Aiel in Landland. So there would have to be a proportionately larger number of men who are able to channel. The idea of an Aiel Ashima is very appealing to me. I really want to see that.
Brandon, very true.
Brandon, are you listening? Probably not.
Well, I think the last major thing to be discussed in deference to this chapter is obviously Egwene goes to have another meeting with Siwan, is interrupted by the long anticipated arrival of the Shanshan strike on the White Tower.
Great timing.
This is the building to what I call the subtitle of this book, that being Egwene is Made of Awesome.
Yeah.
Subsequently also what I entitle, not the next chapter, but the one following it. and of course, for all the description people have, particularly in the White Tower now, of, the Shanshan, beast, it's, amazing to me that, the attack on the White Tower comes and the first thing that almost everybody thinks is, oh, the last battle has come. And of course it's come to the White Tower, which,
of course,
doesn't jive with any of the prophecies or anything at all. It's all...
Well, to be fair, I mean, reality is basically unraveling around them. Horrible things are happening, bubbles of evil, floor and bars melting around people, all kinds of stuff. I mean, who could be blamed for the first thing like that happens? Oh my God, it's Blood Fella!
Yeah, exactly.
I have to have a little sympathy for them. And then,
incidentally, before we leave this particular chapter, I just wanted to make mention that people in Encyclopedia Watt, just to show and give another example of how amazingly in-depth they are at researching everything that goes on in these books, actually do manage to answer one of Egwene's random questions while she's waiting for Siwan. This comes directly from the epilogue of Lord of Chaos. The Mandarin knelt in the Pit of Doom, and for once he did not care that Shadar Haran watched his trembling with that eyeless, impassive gaze. Have I done well, Great Lord? The Great Lord's laughter filled the Mandarin's head. Yes, indeed. In the end of one of the at the end of the chapter notes for chapter 39, they answer his question, or Egwene's question. Yes, the Dark One does laugh.
Yes, he does. Sort of an evil laugh. That evil death thing. Don't think. It's all about the laugh. It's about standards. Okay.
So this, of course, will bring us to chapter 40, The Tower Shakes. Begins with Siwan. She awakes from Teleron Riad, knowing that something is very, very wrong. Bryn also wakes, and she tells him that Egwene is in danger. Maybe Elida has decided to execute her after all. A young soldier, Tijus, urgently calls from the outside the tent and enters to report dark shadows and bursts of light around the area of the White Tower. Siwan realizes these are not shadow spawn, but rather that it must be the Shanshan attack. The flying things are rocking. Siwan decides that now is the time to rescue Egwene, but Bryn, of course, wants no part of it.
Yep, not the last battle. It's the big attack. Big attack. And that must have... Can you imagine looking across the river and seeing that, rocking, circling the White Tower and burst of the One Power back and forth. That must have been amazing.
Well, I mean, it's not just, you know, it's not even with the enhanced eyesight that you get while you're holding Siddhar or Satan, you're not actually seeing them. You're seeing, you know, bursts of the power, you're seeing explosions, you know, fireballs and lightnings. But really, you're only getting silhouettes. You're getting these vague shapes that are, you know, circling the tower. And of course, we're talking again about hundreds of Shanshan flying creatures. I mean, this,
yeah.
You know, I'm imagining, like in the old, when someone would do an animation or an old movie of, you know, Dracula's castle and there's bats flying all around it, you know, I'm kind of imagining something like that, except on a larger scale.
You
know, both
scale.
In the size of the creatures and the amount. And so it's just, you know.
Well, didn't they also have, am I wrong, but did they not have the Rockan set up with, or maybe it was a Tolrockan, had Shuldam and Damani so that they could attack from. They also had Tolrockan going around. I don't think the Rockan could carry more than. Could they carry three people so that they would have a Shuldam and Damani?
I don't know. I mean, it might be possible, but I don't recall off the top of my head.
So what good would Rockan really do flying around if they have nothing with which to attack? Why even bother sending Rockan other than a scout?
Well, I think that, you know, the Shanshan in this assault are wanting to land a significant number of people, and it's very possible that, you know, having excessive numbers of, you know, even if they can only drop off one or two people, the Rockan still are capable of adding extra people. I mean, you send out, you know, 50 Rockan, that's, you know, 50 to 100 extra people on the ground. So, I mean, it is very possible that, I mean, they were just used as kind of light passenger transport as well. Or even, you know, yeah, I mean, those would probably be the most direct things that I could think of. But I don't, like I said, I don't really recall exactly what the carrying capacity of a Rockan is. It might just be two people, but
if they could just carry three, they could take the flyer and then a Shuldam and the Damani, which would make them extraordinarily.
True.
In that case, you know, like they could attack from the air. And I noticed they were going to do that with the Tolrockan.
According to Encyclopedia Watch, description of the Rockan, a large flying creature, very much like a European dragon. They can carry two riders and are used by the Shanshan's flying transport. Yeah, I don't know. The interesting thing is that, you know, in the similar notes about the Rockan, it says that the Empress orders the use of 100 Rockan and Tolrockan.
Yeah.
You know, 100 might be the total number between the two. And therefore, you know, there might have been just less Rockan in general.
Yeah. Yeah, they were just using those for the scouts and you know, basically air support. And the Tolrockan were the ones that were delivering. But I think it sounds from the way Taurus thinking about it in that chapter that this is one of the first times that they really used, you know, Tolrockan as attack vehicles rather than dropping off, you know, Fists of Heaven and Shuldam and Damani to the ground. They're actually using these Tolrockan sort of like fighters, you know, fighter planes in a way, not really jets, but fighter planes to carry people who can attack from their backs. So this may be a little bit innovative, but it's certainly pretty obvious from our perspective, you know, knowing that we have, you know, aircraft, fighter craft in our world. I'm kind of surprised that Gareth Bryn doesn't want any part of it, even though there's an attack on the tower. I guess he just doesn't want to try to lose men in a futile attack against handlers, but her orders were not to rescue her, so I guess he's just going to stick with those until he hears differently.
Yeah, I mean, that is true. I really got that. You know, Egwene has impressed such a loyalty on Gareth that he just, you know, she says, you know, don't come and get me. Means don't come and get me. You know, I'm sorry.
Yeah, too bad.
You know, sometimes, sometimes you have to obey an order that, you know, you don't like, but, you know, you obey it nonetheless because that's what your commander tells you to do.
Yeah, too bad Gallen hasn't got that yet. So moving on to the next point of view in this chapter, it's from Egwene's point of view, and she tells Nicola that the attack is not the last battle, but it's a Shanten raid meant to capture Maat Lamani. Nicola wants to flee, but Egwene says that they will fight. She collects as many novices as she can, including Jasmine, Yuteri, Inala, Tamala, and many others. With help from Nicola, she then teaches them to form a circle. While she's linked with the novices, even though she is filled with Slurkroot, Egwene has enough strength to open the gateway to the Angreal storeroom where she fetches the white-booted wand. They are now ready to fight. This is such an amazing chapter. Of course, the Angreal that they fetch is the white-booted wand. The white-booted rod is the one that they used to kill Maat way back in the very beginning. Is that the Great Hunt of the Dragon Reborn?
Yeah, it is in the Dragon Reborn the healing actually takes place.
Yeah.
Okay. But yeah, this is one of the most, you know, powerful objects of the One Power for women that the tower possesses. And it is just astonishing. Yeah, you know, now armed with this knowledge of where the storeroom is, you know, that now that she's decided, you know, to really go in and, you know, fight wholeheartedly for the White Tower, it doesn't really matter, you know, what the opponent is, whether, you know, it's Elida and her, you know, ignorance of the Shanshin and, you know, giving her access, you know, to this just really reinforces, you know, her strength character, so.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I think it's kind of interesting that even linked with the novices, you know, she does have enough strength to open the gateway, but good for those novices. It's not an easy thing to learn to do, the link, you know, when a battle is raging all around you if they don't know already. You know, pretty good job. This whole thing just amazes me. I mean, no matter what happens to her, Egwene overcomes. She copes. And she just deals with it. I mean, here she is, filled to death with Slurkroot. I mean, not filled to death. Here she is, filled with Slurkroot, as usual. And instead of, like, Nicola wanting to flee or taking the easy course and gathering people and getting them out of the tower, she's going to fight. And she figures out, under pressure, a way to do it. I'm, like, so impressed. So explain.
<Yeah.
laughs>
Well, the thing to note, too, I was surprised with this, that linked with the circle of novices, Egwene is just about as strong as she would be otherwise.
I know.
As well. I mean, it just kind of gives you an idea of where this, you know, small circle is as far as, you know, their current power output.
Yeah, well, the novices obviously aren't very far along, and they can't handle large amounts of the power. Those typical novices, not like the Wonder Girls, but I think it's interesting. I mean, what would Egwene be like, you know, at full strength with this looted wand? Oh my goodness.
Yeah,
pretty amazing. And the other thing that's sort of, we've talked about this before, but I really think that she's grown somewhat tolerant to the Slurkroot, that it doesn't have quite the same effect on her anymore, because gosh, when even Elaine got dosed with the Slurkroot, of course, they're giving her a smaller amount so that she can function and isn't, you know, gibbering and asleep and everything else. But still, it should be able to pretty much keep her from channeling. Although, now that I remember, I think when she originally was going to novice classes, she could channel just enough of a trickle to make the little balls of light fly around and so forth. So, but I still wonder if she isn't just getting tolerant enough to it that she will eventually, not that she's going to need to anymore, but she would have eventually been able to channel a little bit anyway.
Yeah, I don't know. It might be possible, but I can't really, I don't know if we'll ever, you know, get a chance to find that sort of thing out.
Probably not. This will be one of those things that does not get resolved. It's really not important anyway.
Yeah. We continue from Egwene's point of view, to Samwan. Swan goes to Gawain for help, and he, of course, quickly agrees to mount a rescue mission for Egwene. They will use the passage that Shemarin discovered to get into Tarbalon. Bryn grudgingly agrees to go with them, but only if Swan will agree to two demands. The first demand is that she bond him as her warder. She agrees to this, and they are fully aware of each other's feelings at last. Gawain then brings Bella for her to ride, and Bryn will bring along 100 guards. The second of Bryn's demands is not immediately made, and we will get to that at a later point.
So here's the big scene. Finally, after all this time, she bonds it. Wow. And this is sort of like an aside as they're going on to mount the rescue. I really thought it would be a bigger thing, but then it just got over with. Yeah, okay.
Well, I love that, Gareth is bonded, and, the first things out of his mouth are just, how amazing he feels, and, I could take on 10 men, and, and Swan's, of course, is a little put out by this. It's like, seriously, that's the first thing that's out of your mouth when you... This is just, again, I love that they kept that kind of playful banter between the two of them. It is not, immediately altered, and it doesn't really, take the amount of developing that it kind of seems that Moraine and Lon had to work themselves up to.
Yeah, well, it's so funny, too, because really, that's such a guy thing. I could take on 10 men now.
Well, it...
Oh, so cute. They are a really cute couple together, I have to say. They are almost as funny in their way as Matt and Juan. I thought it was kind of fun that Derek Wynn was the one to ask. I always thought it would be Juan grudgingly, admitting that she needed him and asking him to be her warder. I never really thought that he would ask her.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I could see it in Gareth as a character.
Yeah.
He seems to be, pragmatic, and he can guess that she's got feelings for him, but he can't really ever directly know it until they're bonded. And, rather than, being the old fool and, going off and just, confessing his feelings and, asking her to marry him, it seems like, if I have her take me as a warder, then number one, I'll know. And, number two, if she doesn't feel any more for me, at least this, keeps me with her. So,
yeah.
I mean, I can see this in a rather romantic light as well as the practical nature of, she's a quote unquote young Aes Sedai. She needs to have somebody watching her back because she's just headstrong enough to get herself killed if someone isn't doing it. And there you go.
Yeah. Well, another thing that really struck me about this is that, we've always sort of thought of Gareth as one of the quintessential warder types. He's just good. He's a great warrior, but this is the first of the great captains that we've heard of in modern times, anyway, to be bonded as a warder. Obviously we've got Lon, a king, bonded as a warder, but he's sort of a special case. But Gareth Quinn is one of the great captains of the age, along with Agelmar and Iturralda and the late and not very lamented Pedro Nile. It's pretty amazing when you think about it, but he's just going along with this. He's going to be a warder. Wow.
Yeah.
And how does this tie in with Min's viewing that they need to stay together or one of them will die? Well, now they don't have to stay together, but they're linked, and if something happens to her, certainly he'll die.
I sort of see at least part of that viewing coming to its conclusion in the next couple of chapters. But now they are closer together, and being bonded this way gives them, a distinct advantage over anything that might harm one or the other or, cause the death of one or both of them, so.
Yeah, I know, so it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. Another little interesting sidelight. Bella, again, Bella riding into battle.
I have been amazed at how many horses have survived such a long time in such difficult conditions. I mean, Rand goes through horses like water.
But Titashar has lasted pretty well.
Titashar, Stepper.
Yeah.
And Perrin's horse Stepper's been around for quite a while.
Yeah. And Thayer, too, the other one.
Yeah.
And Bella. And Pips.
Pips.
Yep. Still got Pips.
Of course, Matt, out of all the main characters, you would expect Matt's horses to last, because Matt's the type to care for horses. He doesn't, you know, he wouldn't run one to death unless he absolutely had to. And,
yeah. Well, Perrin, too. One of the reasons his horse survived Duma as well is that, you know, he actually reflects to himself that he could, I think it was Duma as well, that he could... choose for his horse, and today he chose no, so he agrees to run along at the Brain's stirrup, you know, because he doesn't want to ride his horse into that, you know, butcher's field.
Yeah. But then again, of course, you've got Rand, who's like, I'm just going to ride in. They might throw fireballs at me. You know.
Poor Cloud, poor Red, too bad. I actually don't know what happened to, I think it was Red that he rode at Falmouth. I mean, he rides into the scene, but then suddenly he's on foot. We never do, I don't think, hear what happens to his horse. He just ran off.
I don't know. I mean, theoretically, it might have gotten picked up and taken to the camp where you begin the Dragon Reborn, but I think Rand leaves from there on foot. If he doesn't leave from there on foot, then he rides Red to death in trying to escape in his pseudo-early madness.
Leaving Bella on her little mission. The next point of view we have is from Adelorna Bastine, and we find her running through the White Tower in something of a panic. She has seen Josaine dead and Marthera collared. One of her warders is also dead, and Tolaric is dead. Suddenly, she is shielded herself, and a Sildam, who is named Gregana, collars means her city. Adelorna is horrified, but the next moment her collar flies off and a blast of fire takes Gregana. She then sees Egwene with Voras Saangreal. Egwene continues to fight, giving orders to the novices, including Chanel, Clara, and Lucane. Adelorna tries to take over, but Egwene firmly tells her that she is in charge. Adelorna then reluctantly acquiesces. Egwene opens this gateway to the storeroom to get more Angreal. They must prevent any sister who knows traveling from being captured. Adelorna is stunned that Egwene tried to escape, but Egwene replies that she would not have been escaping. She would have been abandoning them. And Egwene intends to win this battle. This is so made of awesome. It's unbelievable. Egwene is, like, so cool. I mean, here she is just telling off the, you know, the head of the Green Aja. Hey, I'm in charge, you know, do this, and just, you know, be quiet about it. One thing I do have to say is that Adelorna is holding up really well for somebody who's just lost one of her warders. She's clearly belongs in the Battle Aja. She's going to deal with her grief later.
I mean, part of that's also, you know, shock at everything that's going on. It's kind of sad, though, that for the Battle Aja, you know, and I think she reflects on this, they're torn to shreds so easily by the Shanshan, the Sildam, and the Damana. I mean, it is insane at how, you know, quickly, had it not been for Egwene, and how horribly badly this battle would have gone. And like I said, how amazingly quickly. I mean, here it is. I mean, we open with her point of view, and, you know, she's running. You know,
yeah.
The commander of the Battle
General.
Lodge
is
running. You know,
mm-hmm.
she's already en route. You know, and it's just, you know, it's amazingly...
How would they have stood up to Dreadlords? I mean, there's no way they could have stood up to Black Aja and Dreadlords if just the Shanshan can break them so quick. I mean, minutes.
She's collared, and again, this is just one of those scenes that you have to have there in front of you. because, I mean, I think this particular moment is one of those wherein I just said, yes, the subtitle of this book is Egwene is Made of Awesome.
Yeah.
You know, then shockingly, the collar unclipped from Maid Lorna's neck and fell to the floor. Gregana looked stunned for a moment before she was consumed in a blast of fire. Maid Lorna's eyes opened wide, and she shied away from the sudden heat. The corpse, in a blackened red and blue dress, crumbled to the ground before her, smoking and reeking of burned flesh. It was then that Maid Lorna became aware of an extremely powerful source of channeling coming from behind. The invaders screamed, the women in gray weaving shields. That proved to be the wrong choice, as both women's leashes unlocked, twisting lines of air unclasping them with dexterous speed. Just a heartbeat after that, one of the women in red and blue disappeared in a flash of lightning, while the other was set upon by tongues of flame, like striking serpents. She screamed as she died, and the soldiers shouted. It must have been the command to fall back, for the soldiers fled, leaving two frightened women who had been unleashed by the tongues of air. Maid Lorna turned hesitantly. A woman in white stood atop the rubble, a short distance away, a massive halo of the power surrounding her, her arm outstretched toward the fleeing soldiers, her eyes intense. The woman stood like vengeance itself, the power of Sedar like a storm around her. The very air seemed light, and her brown hair blew from the wind of the open gap in the wall beside them. Egwene Alvair. You know, it just, here she is, and the rod raised high, and the wind blowing, and the giant halo of power, and, you know, just all of this. And mere seconds worth of movement, but so much packed into that one little space, and, you know, paints just an amazing picture. You know, and kind of as you mentioned later, you know, she tries to assert herself. You've done very nicely to organize Egwene, though it's good that an eyes, you know, Egwene froze to the, or those eyes were so calm, so in control. I am in command until this threat passes. You will call me mother. Give me penance later if you must, but for now, my authority must be unquestioned. Is that clear? Yes, mother, Maid Lorna found herself saying, shocked.
Yeah. How could anybody who has ever seen Egwene like that, like an avenging angel, filled with the power, in charge, in command, how could anybody ever deny her place as Amelin's seat after that? I mean, you'd have to be a moron to try and stand against her after that.
Oh, yeah. Well, and honestly, I'm taken to the, back to the prologue of The Dragon Reborn in this. And, without consciously doing it, Egwene has done what Pedro Niall sort of suggested. You know, in the presence of a rabid lion in the community, you know, under Niall's idea, that particular lion was, you know, set there on purpose by the person. But, you know, this works the same purpose. You know, in the presence of, you know, the chaos of this rabid lion being there, you give an order and people mm-hmm. will obey.
And it's also Davern Bashir told Perrin, you know, when Perrin says, I'm not a lord, it's when the Trollocs attacked, and Davern interrupts him laughing. He says, oh, you think the creator made the houses for you? Well, some people think so, but usually it's just some man who stood up in a crisis, took charge and gave an order, and people followed him. Mm. And it's the same principle with that here. I mean, that's one quick step to keeping your head in a crisis when everybody around there losing theirs, and I just, but I mean, to start right off with the Captain General of the Green, who I have to admit acquitted herself really poorly, and I'm sure to her everlasting embarrassment, acquitted herself really poorly, you know, just breaking and running right at the very beginning. I mean, how in the world does she ever, I mean, she's the best the Green has to offer, excuse me, how in the world did they ever manage to stand up to Dreadlords at the last battle? And the Dark One? Never. Going to happen if that's all it takes to get them fleeing from the White Tower. I was really disappointed and really shocked, to be honest with you. That was just inexcusable, you know, for her to behave in that fashion. She should have been the one rallying, you know, other sisters to try and stand up against it, or at least, if nothing else, try to rally sisters to escape until they could, you know, mount a counterattack. But she's just running. I'm like, oh, that was so disappointing. I just have this mental image of Egwene with her tiny little gaggle of novices behind her, just, you know, absolutely glowing with the power. I can't even imagine what she would have been like had she been at her normal power with Loras around Zangreal. Just beyond belief. I mean, we're always told that she and Nynaeve and Elaine are some of the most powerful channelers living, but we've never really seen them able to use it. This is really one of the first times that they can just step up and be what they are. I mean, they're always, you know, constrained by the rules of the White Tower, and they've never really been able to do the miraculous things that we know they're capable of. And the other thing that, before I forget, you might want to add something to that, but the other thing before I forget is that it struck me that, again, Egwene is cast in the role that I really expected to see Rand filling, the shining beacon of power, justice, good. I mean, Egwene is somebody right out of the League of Justice. I mean, here she is, you know, sensible, stable, normal, just, fair, kind, even kind to her enemies. I mean, she's like the epitome of everything that you would actually want in a leader. The actual very form of being a just and powerful leader. I really thought we'd see Rand, you know, fill in those shoes first, but Egwene has just done it. Not that Rand still can't, but yeah, native awesome.
I do have to make a small exception. She is kind to some of her enemies. Charred remains falling to the ground in a black and red blue dress.
In battle, that's something else. No, I mean, I'm not saying that she's not capable of, you know, certainly, you know, lashing out with the power against her enemies in the heat of battle is one thing. But I mean, in the White Tower, dealing with people that have opposed her, other sisters, and so forth and so on, yeah, she's been more than fair and kind to them. She's been just. She's been gracious. I mean, she could have taken, we'll see more of this later, but I mean, she could have done a lot of things very differently and still achieved her goal. You know, even with people in the Saladar camp, Lomanda and Lelaine, I mean, she had set them down, but she was never vindictive about it. She could have made their lives a living hell once she got the power of the act of war behind her, but she didn't. As long as they step up and toe the line, you know, and they give her at least the minimum respect due to the Omerlin seat, she was good with it. She didn't impose massive penances or, you know, do any of the many petty little vindictive things she could have done. Considering how they treated her all those months, that's a pretty big person not to get some of her own back.
That's true.
I mean, you know, these people, they've been doing to her what they did to Rand, in a sense. They've been beating her. You know, the minute that she got out, did she start thinking about how she was going to get back at them for beating the crap out of her? No. She could have. I mean, she could have escaped any time. Anything that she did in the heat of this last battle, you know, with the Fork Root, she could have grabbed some novices. She could have coerced them into linking with her. She could have gone and found that Zangreal, and she could have escaped, and she could have had vengeance on every sister that laid a hand on her, but she didn't do that. Just, you know, toasting a few sold on. That's probably the kindest thing she could have done to him. What would have been really neat was to have grabbed him and collared him. We know how much they love that, finding out that they're Dumani after all.
I wonder what happens if you were to take two Sildam with the bracelet on their wrists and attach the collars to the other woman.
Say that again?
Well, you take just two Sildam, one each with a bracelet on their wrist, and each of them collars the other woman wearing the other bracelet.
Ooh, feedback link! I don't know. That's kind of scary. Does that mean neither of them can move a step without the other?
Yeah, I mean, I have no idea what that would do to somebody.
I don't know. Sort of like these Siamese twins. I mean, both of them would have control over the other.
Oh.
Good question. They couldn't unleash each other either. Somebody else would have to get them out of it.
Yeah.
Surely somebody's tried that, just out of grins and giggles, but, I don't know. Well, maybe nothing much, or surely the Empress would have done it for entertainment value, wouldn't she? And she can afford to have, you know, lords and ladies hooked up with Fuldom just to see if they die screaming.
There is a note here from Encyclopedia Watts that the attacking force is mostly Tauroken, with some Roken for support, and that the distinction is lost on most of the observers.
Yeah. I mean, most people would have a tough time telling a Roken from a Tauroken unless they saw them together. They just would assume that one's a larger version of the other, I suppose. Oh, and I always wonder who the first person to figure out that they could grab one of these things and tame it was. And it sort of makes me think of that scene in Avatar where they're grabbing their little flying beasties.
I don't know. Yeah, so we will continue from there into the next chapter, 41, A Font of Power. We begin with Gawain's point of view. Convoy of boats with Gawain, Swan, Bryn, and 100 of his soldiers arrive at the water canal into Tarvalon. The soldiers dress as tower guards. They see Roken circling overhead as they make their way into the White Tower. They plan to start searching for Egwene in the basement where the cells are. Pretty straightforward in this section.
Yeah, it really is. I just have to comment that really, these people are pretty brave, you know, going into the White Tower with, you know, the One Tower being used all around and these horrible Roken and Tauroken beasts circling all overhead. You know, that takes a little bit of nerve.
It was also kind of a smart little idea to have everybody dressed as tower guard, because, you know, it could draw the eye potentially of any Shanshan they run into, but it does distract enough that, you know, people who are actually in the tower guard aren't going to be like, hey, there's these people, they were very obviously soldiers, who are coming in while these people are attacking us. Let's having that just that little extra might not fool anybody up close, but I mean, it's at least enough to get them in where they can do what they need to do.
It says, I was going to say, where did they get all those tower guard uniforms on the spur of the moment? But Gareth Bryn, being one step ahead of everybody, says that he had the woman in the outer camp make them. It's always a good idea to have a few copies of your enemy's uniform. And Swan, of course, has to argue. It's not proper, Swan said, holding her arm. Serving on the tower guard is a sacred duty. They're your enemy, Swan, Bryn said sternly. For now, at least, you're not Amelin anymore. I had forgotten about that myself, to be honest with you. I'm a great person for having issues with people conveniently getting stuff. One of my favorite ones is when they go into some of these battles with the maidens. I think Skrulls was one. And they make the maidens all wear red strips of cloth around their upper arms so that they can be distinguished from the Shaido. Where'd you get all that cloth? They've got a couple hundred maidens there. They just travel around the world with bolts of red cloth and their pack horses? Come on. Out in the middle of nowhere.
I don't know.
I don't either. But that's kind of stuff that bothers me. I don't like to see the wires. You know, I don't care whether it's a book or a science fiction movie. I don't want to see the wires holding up the spaceships, okay? Convince me. Anyway, here we go on. So, right, that's a fairly straightforward check. The next one is pretty much the same thing. We have a point of view from the Aes Sedai here in Osnabar, and she is attempting to coordinate the White Tower defense. Good for you. Sorry, no editorializing. Moradri reports that sisters are fighting in small groups of their own Ajahs, and Captain Chubain of the Tower Guards enters. He then reports that the Tower Guard is nearly useless in the defense because it's being conducted mostly with the One Tower. Saren thinks that Egwene was right in predicting the attack, as well as chiding the Ajahs for fighting with each other. Katarine, Natasha, and two other Revs enter. Katarine tries to take over until Saren overrides her. They hear booms that do not shake the tower. A soldier then reports that they are coming from the 22nd floor, the novice quarters. Again, that's another fairly straightforward chapter. There's really not too terribly much to comment on there, except that, you know, go Saren. Good job.
Yeah, definitely.
I just had a quick thought. Isn't it lucky while they're fighting this battle of the White Tower that none of the corridors shift around on them?
Yeah, it was rather fortuitous. I don't know. It would be hard to work in that level of chaos on top of, you know, the chaos of an already normal battle. And we're not really certain still what guides the shifting and stuff enough to, like, you know, I could see maybe if, you know, it were directly evidence that the Dark One, you know, had broken free enough and was able to rearrange, you know, things on purpose, then I could see, you know, yeah, walls popping up in directions or, you know, spaces opening that would lead, you know, the Shanshan directly to their targets. But, you know, it seems like that level is something that they haven't really come into. There's nothing that really evidences any sort of play that way.
Yeah, apparently it's still just a random, you know, shifting, and it happens when it happens, but it's not, you know, a matter of every single day.
Another thing with this, too, is that Saren, it should be noted, is brown. You know, here she is, she's organizing the tower defense. She's standing directly up to the Reds when they come in. You know, they come in and they really try to bowl her over, and she's like, no. You know, sorry. We've seen where you got us. Not going to happen.
I nominate Saren Escobar for Captain General of the Green Aja. Yeah, that was a little role reversal there that kind of bothered me. I mean, you know, poor Adelarna, really. I mean, she's not fared well in these books. She's the Captain General, and she's been birched by Elida. You know, she's been set down by Egwene, not seriously, but made to look foolish, running from the White Tower battle. I don't know, she seems to step down.
So we move on from Saren and return to Egwene. Every time she strikes down a Shanshan, Egwene thinks of Rena. With Bora's white-fluted wand, they cannot shield her except with a circle, and it is learned that the Adam prevents Damane from linking. She strikes Rockan and Torrockan from the sky, especially if they bear captured sisters, but some inevitably escape. She does not think of violating the three oaths. This battle must be fought. The raid must cost, or this raid must cost the Shanshan, too much for a repeat of the attack to ever come again.
I think that it's kind of interesting that she's able to, you know, to justify in her mind not only striking down the Shanshan, but the Rakan that carry the captured sisters as well, you know. She, unlike Rand, has fully grasped the idea that there are unfortunately acceptable losses in battle and sometimes collateral damage, and although Rand did it once outside Kalyan when the Shaido are about ready to take over the gates and get inside the sister, he makes a strike that he knows is going to kill many of his own men as well, but it has to be done because if they get in the city, they'll never get them out. It's going to be a battle in the streets. It'll be a nightmare. And so he does accept it that one time, but he seems to have a really tough time with that, where Egwene makes this decision, you know, in a heartbeat. She's just a born leader. I mean, she just gets it. It doesn't matter what situation you put her in, she gets it. And rises to the top of every single situation she's been put in. You just cannot keep her down.
Well, and I mean, on top of that, she pointed out in the last chapter, they can't allow any sister who has learned traveling to be, you know, to be taken. You know, giving the Shanshan traveling, you know, is, you know, disastrous for, the concept of the One Power in combat. Particularly, what the Shanshan have as their aim for this particular continent.
Yep. Although, realistically, she doesn't know this, but if there are Dark Friends highly placed among them, like Surah, and so forth in time, it's just a matter of time before some Forsaken or somebody decides to teach the Shanshan battle anyway. It's just, once they need him in battle, they're going to teach him.
True.
So it's just a matter of time, but Egwene doesn't know that. She's doing what she can do. Just again, Egwene, she's awesome. There's just no getting around it. Is this the first time that we learn that some prevents Damani from linking with each other? I mean, it's already a link, so I guess that makes sense.
Yeah, I do believe this is that first instance. I mean, it makes sense because already being a involuntary link, it would definitely shorten the circle. It would be kind of weird because, you couldn't have like 13 women together with, 13 other women attached off of them, even though that the women wearing the bracelets would be, it basically comes down to a control issue. Because mm-hmm. with the Damani and the Soldam is the controller in a link of two. And to expand that by adding in a second controller and a second, power source, it seems like it would just cause too many, it would complicate the issue far too much.
I was just thinking that, they have the, I cannot think of the name that they were given, the sad bracelets.
Bands of Dominion.
Oh yeah, I was just thinking they have the Bands of Dominion that they always refer to as the sad bracelets, which have one collar and two bracelets to be meant to be controlled by two women. So why couldn't they create the opposite? One bracelet, two or more collars, so that one Damani could, so that one Soldam could control a number of people together, and that would kind of, now if they're not linked, but they are linked, they're linked with her, but not with each other, maybe their powers wouldn't be additive, but of course, they really don't have to worry about that, because there's way more Soldam than Damani anyway, so it probably never came up, but.
I mean, this is the same reason that you never actually see a Soldam wearing two bracelets.
With two Damani.
It might just be something
anyway.
With the way that the person becomes represented in the Soldam's mind.
I have it in the back of my mind that we did see a Soldam with a bracelet on each wrist and a Damani on each leash, but I can't remember where. Maybe I'm just hallucinating. I'm open for comments on that one. I can't, it seems familiar, but I can't remember where it would have been, so maybe not. That's interesting that, go ahead.
At some point, a friend of mine, when I was still early in the reading of the series, had made mention of something about the Empress having, two, like a Damani on each wrist. And, I never was able to find where that supposition came from, or, I never found any evidence for it. So I just kind of assumed that it was never actually took place, but might have been misread somewhere. I don't know.
Fan fiction. So one thing, the Empress would have to be a Soldam in order to do that, and that would be a really big no-no in Shanshan society. I mean, obviously Tuan is, but that's not well known, and she certainly isn't about to publicize it. That because, Soldam, well, she knows. No, I see. She knows that. I take it back. Strike all that. That's wrong, because she trained to be a Soldam so she could tear her own Damani. It wasn't. Until she learned about it, there was no problem with that, so never mind. Yeah, right. That could be another issue too. I take it back. That never happened. I've forgotten about that. I was thinking that you know, maybe it was in, you know, like fan fiction or something like that, or maybe somebody asked Robert Jordan about it at some signing or something like that. It certainly is a powerful image, you know, an empress having two Damani directly linked to her. Maybe it was Tuon. Thank you. Tuon, when she's teaching at Athena and Teslin and Jolene, she collars two of them, and she's got a bracelet on each wrist in the wagon.
There we are. I had completely forgotten that, yes, she did. She slapped a bracelet on each wrist.
Yep.
So it is technically possible. Oh, yep. Good to know.
I had forgotten about it, too, and it popped into my mind. I thought, okay. Whew. I have on that one. Okay, moving along to the next part of the chapter, which is from Gareth Bryn's point of view, we find Bryn and Igor. We find a mistake right off the bat. We find Bryn dodging falling rocks, fireballs, and rockin'. Bryn thinks that Gowan is fresh when he takes on two Shanshan soldiers at once, but he dispatches both with a single move. They then see someone on a high floor who might be Egwene. If Bryn realizes that Swan is gone, but through the bomb, feel that she is alive and in the tower. She then reappears, dragging a novice named Hashala. Bryn chides her for entering the tower alone, but Swan says even Moraine would not recognize her now. Hashala tells them that Egwene was freed earlier, and she is on the 22nd floor, which confirms their sighting. She wants to help them. A captain named Vestas reports to Bryn that three of the men are seriously wounded, and Swan stops to heal them. As she finishes, Bryn sees a shadow, and with his water-enhanced senses, draws and skewers the man. The man grabs in his wrist, then dies. Swan says that Minwis was right in her viewing, but wait, she said both would die if they did not stay together. Quickly, she delves Bryn, finds poison, and heals him. The man left a tiny poison kid in his wrist. Well, we have notes on that subject, that the man that Bryn killed was one of the blood knives and had a poison needle, apparently. Good thing that Swan was right there and quick on the draw.
Yes, this, of course, is also an instance of one of the only two times that Min has had a viewing that was an if and not a solid beginning to end action sequence. And it basically relies on the idea that if Min had not mentioned the viewing to Siwon, Siwon wouldn't have had any impetus to delve Bryn, and he would have died of the poison. And so in this case, the viewing actually affects the outcome. And that is, you know, a grand possibility for why the viewing was an if, is that, you know, had Min not mentioned it, Bryn would be dead at this point.
Yeah, of course she would have started to feel it when the poison took effect and would have realized there was something wrong with him, and maybe she could have healed him quickly enough to overcome it, but it certainly was a lot easier for her to just, you know, do it before the poison really even got started. I don't know how quick acting a poison it was. But
then, of course, on the other hand, the viewing also prompted Siwon to keep Gareth close to her, rather
mm-hmm.
than just, you know, taking the easy way out of her death, which she probably wouldn't have done anyway. You know, if Siwon hadn't stayed so close, Bryn probably would never have gotten around to asking to be made warder. And
yeah.
When they were, you know, if they were even together during this assault, she would not have had a warder who could have noticed the blood knife in time to kill him.
That's true. But then again, you know, she goes running off into the tower to do something and then comes back. I mean, how close is close? She probably needs to stay really close. But maybe anyway, it worked out pretty well.
Yes.
I do want to comment that we're seeing a lot of new, you know, characters, and I think that that's probably Brandon finding names for a lot of the people that donated to the Heifer International Crusade a couple of years ago, and part of their reward was to get a name in the book, a suitably Wheel of Time-ized name.
Definitely possible.
Yeah. Pick me,
well,
Brandon, pick me.
Well, at this point,
Sorry. Go ahead.
So at this point, we leave Siwan and Gareth and Gawain and return once again to Egwene. The Seanchan have fled, and Egwene is exhausted from the battle, barely able to stay awake. She barely notices when someone picks her up. It is Gawain. She can hear Siwan and Brynn as well. Siwan finds the white-fluted wand, and she uses it to make a gateway and travel for their escape. Egwene tries to resist, but is just too thoroughly exhausted.
That's kind of interesting. I hadn't realized that Siwan is now too weak to travel by herself. I just hadn't thought about it.
Yeah. We always keep references to how weak she has become, but like Aes Sedai, they don't actually focus on it very much at all, so.
Yeah. Except for their strange hierarchy of who's to be deferred to and who not. So that's interesting. So now they've got Egwene out of the tower, and they also have one of the most powerful Thangreal known to the Aes Sedai in their possession. That could be handy.
Yes, definitely indeed. Although it should be noted that Egwene was none too pleased with this rescue attempt. As Siwan is leading them to the gateway, Egwene thinks to herself, "No." Egwene thought, clawing through her drowsiness, forcing her eyes open. "I'm winning, don't you see? If I offer leadership now, when the rubble is being cleared, they'll see me as Merlin for certain. I have to stay, I have to." Gawain carried her through the gateway, leaving the hallways of the White Tower behind. It was just that entire desperate, "No! Oh, do what I say! Do what I say!" kind of sort of sadness that, at first she doesn't even realize what's going on.
"Oh no, I can't have my tower now." Oh, poor Egwene. That sort of unraveled a lot of her plans. But then, she certainly, she's in no state to do anything right now, and there's nothing to prevent her once she's, a little bit rested and the fork root is worn off while using the rod. Nothing to prevent her from traveling right back there, as though she was just, in disarray from the battle and comes back. But yeah. She obviously, if she's that exhausted she can barely stay awake, she's not going to do anything for the next, 5 or 6 hours anyway. And so, what part of, rallying the forces of the White Tower is she going to actually be able to do right away? Nothing, so. But I think Gawain's in for a big tongue-lashing when she wakes up. Maybe Siwan and Brynn, too. You got anything else on Gawain? That was a particular point of view. So then we move on to going back to Sarah and Asnabar's point of view. The battle is now over, and Sarah is reviewing their losses. There are many dead, including over 20 Aes Sedai. The Yellow and Brown sisters are working to heal the wounded and using heal-all herbs on the less serious. Saren wonders where Elida is. She is astounded at the report on Egwene. Only 3 of 60 novices and 1 of 40 Aes Sedai were killed. 10 Damani captured. Over 30 Rakan destroyed. Captain Jubain enters, bringing an accepted named Mare, who is attending Elida. She tearfully recounts that the wall collapsed and fell on her. She could not do anything to stop it. She also
says
that Elida...
Did you say cheerfully or cheerfully?
Yeah, cheerfully, I think, for me. "She's gone! She's gone!" She's not dead, she's just gone. So, at this point in time, basically, it's not clear, but the actual chapter is, she comes to report Saren, and Saren, who goes crying and curtsying and wincing, and spit it out, Saren demands, "This isn't a night for dawdling," and Mare looks down, "It's the Obelin, Saren said I. Elida said I. I was attending her tonight, taking transcriptions for her ends." "And what?" Saren said, feeling a growing chill. The girl started crying. "The entire wall burst in, Saren said I. The rubble covered me. I think they thought I was dead. I couldn't do anything. I'm sorry." "But might intercede," Saren thought. "She can't be saying what I think she is, can she?" But, moving on to the next point of view.
Yeah, so despite Saren's fervent hopes that she is not hearing what she is thinking she is hearing, Elida awakes to a sensation of movement and wind and wonders if Carlia left the window open. She realizes suddenly that she is hundreds of feet in the air. She tries to embrace the true source, but feels pain instead. The voice whispers to her that her name is now Sufa, and she will be a good demone. Elida screams, despite the pain.
Justice at last. Well,
the downside of this, of course, is that we do now know that Ishanshin have captured at least one Aes Sedai who knows traveling. So we have no idea where that's going to go, or even when this mystery Sol'dahm will gain praises from the Empress.
She also knows a few other weaves, too, like the new healing and anything else that Berowyn revealed. Is it Berowyn? Beonin. I mean, yeah, she knows a few other weaves, like the new healing and anything else that Beonin, you know, has revealed to her. So she could be useful. Now the question is she going to be loyal enough to the White Tower to not mention those things unless she's directly questioned and made to reveal them, or is she going to just blurt out everything she can in hope of some preferential treatment? Guess we'll find out how tough Elida really is.
Well, the problem is the emotions that are fed through the Adam. You know, we see this in, you know, the Great Hunt. You know, they're really easily readable by the women who wear the collar. And so it's pretty obvious that, you know, if they don't immediately just say, now, you're going to show me all the weaves you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's going to have to do that. And if she, you know, tries to resist or hold back in that, you know, they hear they're going to know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it is one of those things that, yeah, unless they just go about their own method of,
Well, and how widely known is it among the Shanshan that the opposing forces can travel? We know that Zorof revealed it to the captain in the field, in the last book, that it was in Path of Daggers. That the Ashaman could be, you know, showing up any time by traveling, but I don't know how really widely spread among, you know, the rank and file Sol'dahm and Mani the belief of traveling is known. I don't know if they tried to keep it under wraps or not. Some of the battle leaders know about it, but I don't know if everybody does. If they don't know about traveling, they'll be in the same state as Elaine and Nynaeve with Mogedion. They won't know to ask. That one probably isn't going to get a call, Raphael. Is it Raphael or Raphael? I always forget.
It depends on who's saying it.
I might have even hoped for something harsher for Elida, but I'm really pleased that she's going to be on the other end of the leash now. Good for her. What a little jerk she's been through this whole book. Doesn't bother me at all that she's going to be stuck on the end of a leash forever.
No, that's true.
Hopefully forever. I mean, who knows? She could be released. Who knows what will happen? I seriously doubt the White Tower is going to mount any sort of a rescue attempt. Do you think? I mean, why would Egwene want her back?
I don't know. I mean, honestly, it would have to be a rescue attempt, and knowing the numbers of Sol'dahm and Damane, I can't imagine that even a coordinated strike by the White Tower would be anything but disastrous. So,
well, it would have to be something on the order of, you know, Moraine and Lon freeing Karen from the White Cloaks, or something like that. It would have to be done sneakily somehow, and I just don't know if, I don't know if Egwene would even go there. But first of all, how badly did they want Elida back? Well, she might want the other sisters that were captured back, but then finding them in the midst of all the Sol'dahm and the money might be tough. It may just be a question of writing them off because of collateral damage.
So I think that'll pretty much wrap up our discussion of these particular chapters. If you see anything that we missed or have any ideas about the things we've said, any theories or anything, there's of course a number of ways to get a hold of us.
So until the next episode, when we will be continuing our review of The Gathering Storm, with Miss Virginia, hoping that the light illumine you until we meet again.
And until next time, may you find water and shade.
And for myself, Andrew Gellis, and everyone here at the Fourth Age, Saravian and Domanchima, Heishite.
The Fourth Age podcast is brought to you by Dragonmount.com. To contact us, visit our website, bit.ly/Fourth Age.
I'll be shocked to my boots.
See, that's sad, because the only thing I could think was, shocked to his boots, and it's too late.
You give him love, badly. The wheel leaves, it's the wheel. I can't say that. The wheel leaves, it's the wheel will. You know, that's harder to say than you might think.
The wheel leaves, the wheel will.
They got podcasts with that.
No.
All right. Trip to the local tavern or something. I mean, you're not going to be saying that at all.
Yeah, well, we just, will what?
Wait, what?
The will who? What? What's the weaving? Stop weaving! Dodge and weave! Dodge and weave!
You're making me dizzy. Stop weaving!
No.
Damn that wheel!